Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Hope you survived July 4th. Our guest today is Kim Whaley. By the way, thanks for coming back. Appreciate it very much.
Oh, it's always a pleasure for me.
Now, I want to talk to you about your new book, which is out this month, How to Read the Constitution and Why, which seems like an incredibly timely thing today, especially for those of us who wonder whether we actually still have a constitution. So tell me, first of all, how is this book going to be different than other books about the Constitution? Because that's not a new story, right?
Sure. I mean, I haven't read every book, obviously, about the Constitution, but my sense is most of them describe what's already in the document, or they're sort of higher level scholarly analyses that requires some measure of expertise already. This book is kind of a citizen's guide. It's the equivalent almost of a first year law school class. It teaches how to start legal analysis from the plain language of the Constitution, where the gray areas and the wiggle room is, how to think about legal questions, and how the Supreme Court addresses them. It's written in everyday language. It uses examples from your daily life so that people can kind of glom onto the concepts and hold them and keep them rather than, you know, read something that is kind of impenetrable and intimidating and walk away not really sure what it means.
Yeah, I think that of course is the problem that a lot of lay people have, is that things get too wonky. And you point out in your introduction that the book is designed to give you a better understanding of the headline news and analysis that deals with the Constitution. But if you are looking for something that will confirm your side of things politically, you might be wasting your time. So this is not a partisan polemic.
No, it is definitely not a partisan polemic. It's a rule of law document. That is, it explains what the rules are and how to think about the rules. And then people can debate politically or policy-wise what to do about the ambiguity. But I think it's really important to have a baseline that we can all agree on, especially in an environment where facts and law get distorted constantly with this onslaught of information through social media, cable news, other internet outlets. I'm not saying that these are nefarious people that are feeding this kind of information, but in this black and white bottom line world, a lot of the legal nuance, which is so important right now, gets it distorted and people get it wrong.
Yeah, I'm constantly struck by how little most Americans understand about the basic principles of the Constitution, including people who opine about public policy. So, for example, on your very, very first page, you point out that the Constitution is a document that puts certain things beyond popular vote by making those things clear in writing. The Constitution is not democratic in that sense. The Constitution is not designed to solve problems or get things done, is it?
No, that's a great way of putting it. I think I also use the analogy, there's no Constitution cop on the block. People think, oh, that's my constitutional right, where it's not something that just hangs around in your backyard that comes in to save us when, you know, government gets too powerful or government starts bullying. The Constitution is really, at least the first three parts of the Constitution is really a job description. It explains the role of our elected and appointed officials. It's kind of a conduit for the people's power. But if those rules aren't enforced, just like any job that we go to, I mean, if someone starts stealing money from the till and there's no consequences, then the no stealing rule is irrelevant. And the Constitution's the same way. It has a set of rules, but they have to be enforced. If they're not enforced, they don't mean anything.
And this is what's frustrating for some folks, is that the Constitution is specifically designed to make it hard to do certain things, right? I mean, it is designed to slow down the democratic process. And it was written by people who were actually, I would say, somewhat cynical about human nature and about the nature of politics.
Yeah, so I've spoken to people from, you know, other parts of the world, like Pakistan, for example, who say, why don't you just change it? If it doesn't work, why don't you change it? And the framers specifically made it very, very hard to amend the Constitution so that it wouldn't be just sort of whimsical and sort of you know, could be amended based on whatever the political whims are at a particular moment. But of course, as you mentioned, the framers understood that it's human nature to amass power. It doesn't matter where you are in the political spectrum. And of course, at the time of the framing of the Constitution, there were no political parties, and the framers really didn't like the idea of political parties. The Democrats versus Republicans were never supposed to be part of our constitutional democracy. But what was supposed to be part of our constitutional democracy is the idea that there's checks and balances. That isn't specifically in the Constitution, but the structure itself suggests no one's above the law. We hear this all the time. But what that really means is that no president, no member of Congress, no federal judge has unlimited power without the other branches checking it. And when we hear things like, oh, Congress is overreaching in investigating the executive branch, that is just foundationally wrong as a matter of how our government is set up. And it's set up that way for a reason, because the framers were really, really worried about individuals, the little guy, getting bullied by an overly powerful government.
So you also write, these days the American system of government seems off. The simple levers of democracy aren't working the way we've always assumed they must. We're not the shining light of freedom for the rest of the world anymore. Lots of things are going on that undermine the government envisioned by the framers of the Constitution. So what I think the framers envisioned a great deal, but there was a lot that they would be shocked by that they did not.
Well, I mentioned one of them, that is the political parties. I think big data technology has, you know, drastically sort of morphed how we should think about the law, and neither the Constitution nor statutory law can keep up with it, let alone figure out how to stay ahead of it. Of course, we have a disconnect between how campaigns are financed and how political candidates are, you know, who they're sort of answering to. That is, the framers, I think, ideally thought it would be the individual voters whose position and policy objectives were paramount, whereas today, because of gerrymandering, because of money in politics, and of course the Citizens United opinion, which is quite controversial, which sort of gave corporations First Amendment rights, basically allowing a lot of money into our political system. The fact, you know, that we don't have term limits for members of Congress, of course, that is not forbidden by the Constitution. But all of these things have kind of separated the individual voter from the democratic process. And as a constitutional scholar, I'll tell you, there are lots and lots and lots of times, most recently with the court's gerrymandering decision, where the court will say, the reason we're coming out this way is because it should be resolved by the Congress, by the voters, by the electoral process, by the political process. And not many people have really thought this through. Okay, well, if that's how the Supreme Court makes its decisions in a lot of big cases, let's hope when it punts to the political process, it's actually working the way the court assumes it's working in making that kind of broad constitutional statement. And I would just say, no. I mean, when we have, even in the Senate, we have, you know, population is expanded from the time of the framing of the Constitution in 1787 astronomically. And we've got, you know, a 66-1 differential in membership representation in the Senate, for example. Every state gets two senators no matter what. That was controversial at the framing of the Constitution. They decided to make sure each state had retained its sovereignty, so we didn't have a proportional representation in the Senate. But as it turns out, then you have, you know, places like California that get two senators, and then, you know, places like Wyoming with a fraction of their population also getting two senators. And in that instance, the Wyoming voters' vote counts a lot more than the person in California. And as we've seen under Mitch McConnell, the Senate has extraordinary powers under the Constitution that the House does not. They're in charge of actually impeaching a president, that is, making a determination that high crimes and misdemeanors occurred. And secondly, of course, the Senate is the linchpin for any judicial nomination and confirmation or confirmation to the president's cabinet. So those are levers of power that the House does not have. So that's just another example. There are just a lot of pieces of it that don't match up with what we assume when we go to the polls.
Yeah, I want to go through that. Some of the myths, you say, that still subsist around the Constitution, including, you argue that the strict reading of the Constitution is a myth. And I want to dive into this after a short break.
We'll be back in a minute, but first, let's talk about sleep. Listen to these studies from Harvard and Johns Hopkins. Chronic sleep deprivation has been shown to lead to depression, diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular disease because, frankly, we all need 8 hours of sleep, right? Right. You know that. You know how cranky you are if you don't get it. You know how lousy your day is if you don't get 8 hours of sleep. But one of sleep's biggest problems, it's temperature. It's tough to get good sleep if you're too hot or too cold. So I want to tell you about the Pod by 8 Sleep. The Pod by 8 Sleep is a high-tech bed designed specifically to help you achieve optimal sleep fitness. It was developed by leading sleep researchers after tracking 43 million hours of sleep. And here's how it works. It combines dynamic temperature regulation and sleep tracking to enhance your rest and recovery. It learns your personal sleep habits and adjusts the temperature automatically. That means if you like the bed cool, like I do, and if your partner likes the bed warm, well, now you can have both at the same time in a crazy comfortable bed. Sleep longer and deeper so you wake up refreshed and ready to take on the world. So to celebrate Independence Day this year, get a free gravity cooling blanket plus free shipping with your Pod purchase. That's a $300 value free. The offer ends next Monday, July 8th. Just visit 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's 8sleep.com/bulwark.
Okay, so we're back with Kim Whaley, whose book is incredibly valuable. I mean, this is really extremely timely for people who want to have an introductory book, who don't want to pick up Black's Law Dictionary, but want to understand what these issues are. The book is How to Read the Constitution and Why. So let's get into this. You argue that it is a myth that judges read the Constitution strictly. What do you mean?
Well, we hear this black and white statement when we see Supreme Court nominees. I want someone who's going to stay within the boundaries of the Constitution, to strictly read the Constitution, to not have a living Constitution. The idea being conservative justices only apply the plain language and don't project or implement their own policy or ideological objectives, whereas the more progressive wing kind of goes off the rails and reads all this stuff into the Constitution. That's a myth, in that the Constitution is old. And it's, if we had everything written into it, it would go on for thousands of pages. It's old and it's short. And like the Bible or the Quran, or as I say in the book, a poem, it has a lot of ambiguity and blank spaces. And both sides of the sort of ideological spectrum on the Supreme Court fill in those blanks. I mean, unreasonable searches and seizures, Fourth Amendment. What does the word unreasonable mean? It's not in the Constitution. It's not defined anywhere. Someone has to fill in that blank. And I also tell my students, when there's a 5-4 opinion on the Supreme Court, that means that four justices, smart people that are highly educated, experts in constitutional law, read a term potentially differently than the other five, that there were good arguments on both sides. That, by definition, means it's not a black and white endeavor.
And one of the examples you use there is Article 2 of the Constitution, which seems pretty straightforward, you know, that says that all the executive power shall be vested in the president of the United States. So, you know, that seems pretty clear, isn't it?
Well, it does. But then you ask, what does executive power mean? There's no definition of executive power. And, you know, just to shift to this idea of, you know, agencies having too much regulatory power. We hear this all the time. We have to rein in the bureaucracy. Too much regulation. Well, when agencies make regulations, agencies are part of the executive branch. So technically, it should be executive power. That is enforcing a law made by someone else. But agencies actually, when they make regulations, they're making laws. So they're doing something that looks a lot like what Congress should be doing. Some justices say, like Justice Thomas would say, that's unconstitutional. Only Congress can legislate. Justice Scalia, right, who's an icon of kind of conservative constitutional ideology, wrote that actually, no, that's executive power. Even though they're making rules, that is implementing what Congress did in a statute, where Congress will pass a statute and say, agencies, you can fill in the blank. So we can sort of get into, you know, philosophical discussions, theoretical discussions, on where is the line between executive power and legislative power. And that's what scholars do. That's what Supreme Court justices do. Regular people aren't in the business of doing that, understandably. But to suggest, rip from headlines, the idea that there's a very clear, easy, honest way of reading it and a dishonest way is just, I think, a distortion and unfortunate.
I like this from the book. Good judging, like good governance, requires transparency, reasoned decision making, and sound judgment. To expect judges not to make judgments is illogical. To pretend that those cloaked with a strict reading mantra are somehow not judging but merely translating English into English is folly. Okay, here's another one. You say that American values are not laid out in the Constitution. Some people might bridle at that. What do you mean?
Well, we hear, I mean, we the 4th of July, right, we just had, and we talk a lot about American values and you know, this idea of liberty and justice and integrity and honesty, and we can go on, and some of them are in the Declaration of Independence, but these terms aren't actually in the Constitution itself. And when I say that, if it's not in a law that is enforceable, that you can go to court and say, hey, you did an unreasonable search and seizure of my home, police officer, so I want to get money from you from a judge, right? That's a law. That's a cause of action. These other sort of like what I call in the book soft norms, these values, are just floating around in our culture, in our societal structure, in our political structure, that we assume people who take on the mantle of office will follow them, just like we might go to a church or some other place of worship and have certain values that we want to teach our children and we want to live our lives. Those values aren't enforceable in court. That being said, they do inform how certain judges read the Constitution, for example, and I think they are a fair standard for people to think about in going to the ballot box. But the reason I raise that is because, again, I think there, just like there's no Constitution cop on the block, there's no values, governmental, you know, liberty, you know, American values cop at the end of the block. If we want those values to stay in our culture and stay in our government and stay kind of in the spirit of our democratic process, we have to hang on to them and enforce them and essentially, you know, say to people in office that aren't adhering to those, we don't want you. We want someone else. We want maybe someone else who has the same political ideology, the same policy objectives, but functions or lives in the world in a way that's consistent with these values.
You also point out that no constitutional power is absolute because there's so much ambiguous language. It's rare for courts to conclude that a certain enumerated power is absolute, meaning that it's not susceptible to limitation by other provisions of the Constitution.
Yeah, so this actually is the issue that prompted my writing the book, my starting to, you know, write and speak publicly on the Constitution, which was I was, you know, sitting a couple summers ago reading the New York Times, and there was a statement in an article that the pardon power, the president's pardon power, is absolute.
Right.
And that really, as an legal educator, bothered me. And so I wrote my first op-ed and said, you know what, it's not absolute. You know, the president couldn't, for example, pardon everyone in federal prison who was white and Caucasian. That would violate the Equal Protection Clause. So that's an example. You can, this is what, you know, law professors and lawyers and judges do. There are hypotheticals where any exercise of power could bump up against another part of the Constitution. And that's by design. That is, so no one amasses so much power that a president, for example, could just arbitrarily exercise it. I'm going to have, you know, the federal marshals shoot every fifth person in the head that walking down the street. I mean, this sounds outrageous,
right,
but that would be arbitrary. That would violate the due process clause of the Constitution, where before the government takes your life or your liberty, you get some kind of a hearing. Even though the president has a lot of power, that would bump up against another part of the Constitution. That's my point. But if we allow, say, if we allowed the president to execute such a ridiculous and tyrannical directive, then the due process clause, we might as well get our black Sharpie out and cross it out. It's a roadmap for our government, but if we allow it to be, you know, bulldozed, then it's not going to protect us anymore. And what I like, you know, we're so politically divided, but people have to understand this roadmap is goes both ways. So you might love your current president or not be great, very excited about your current president, but the next one could be your worst nightmare. And if you've allowed these protections or limitations on government power to be basically bulldozed over or erased or the black Sharpie out, guess what? The next person who you don't like is going to be able to exercise that level of power as well. You've just changed the roadmap or the blueprint for the amount of power government gets.
And, you know, I think that conservatives used to understand that. I think they used to understand that at a pretty deep level until about 5 minutes ago. And I think we saw that, you know, how far they have strayed from that when so many Republicans went along with the president's emergency order on the ballot on the border, which, again, even though they were warned, you know, what a president Kamala Harris might do or a president Bernie Sanders might do with those powers. So let's go back to this pardon thing, because that is close to an absolute right, but you're a power. But you are right. There are obvious limitations. But let's say that Donald Trump pardoned all the members of his family, all Republicans in federal prison, and himself. Who stops him?
There are two places. The federal courts can stop him, or we stop him at the ballot box. But of course, the pardon power is normally historically used in that sort of gray area, the lame duck period, where a new president has been elected. And so the outgoing president has all this power, but is not politically accountable for the exercise of that power.
Right.
That is, they pardon, you know, someone that is politically, you know, volatile, gets people really angry, but you can't vote that president out of office. They're leaving. This president doesn't seem to be feel constrained by that. But to answer your question, if he were to do this in a second term, or in between, either now or sometime before the end of a second term, it would be what we've seen. It would be some kind of federal lawsuit. But we know under the Justice Department, you can't utilize the courts at least directly against the president. If there were, for example, a commission of a crime, can't see how a pardon would, you never know, but would actually function as a crime. Or there would have to be some political accountability, which is either for the presidency not vote him into office a second time. So, you know, 2020 is an absolutely crucial turning point for our democracy, not just for this presidency, or impeachment. And as I mentioned earlier, if the Senate is saying, listen, there's no way essentially that we'd ever impeach this president, then the impeachment clause kind of becomes, you know, a null set. And then we're left with what? We're left with the next presidential election because you can't use the courts.
Yeah, these are not self-actualizing, which is why the constitutional concept of constitutional norms is so important.
None of it is self-actualizing, you know, and I use a lot of analogies in the book. So, you know, you say you want to renovate your bathroom and you might get on Angie's List or ask your friends for an honest person. So there's the soft norm. There's these value system that's important to you, that you check your references and make sure the person they're going to give money to come into your home and actually do damage to your home before they beautify it. It has some integrity and a decent reputation. And then say the person comes in, takes $10,000 as a down payment and demos your bathroom and then leaves your house worse off than when you started. The contract that you signed, which would be more like the Constitution or a statute, a criminal statute, say campaign finance laws, barring certain kinds of donations, that is not itself, the piece of paper doesn't get you your money back. You have to go to court and file a lawsuit for breach of contract and then have a court issue an order in your favor, and then you'd have to actually have to have that order executed. So if then the contractor says, I don't care what the court says, and that's not unimaginable with this president, right? The president say it's a fake court, I'm ignoring the order of a federal judge, then literally you'd have to get the marshal or at the federal level or the sheriff at the local level to physically go to the contractor's house or to put a lien on his bank account to get the money back. I mean, government would have to step in to enforce its power to get you your money back. And the Constitution the same way. If we're not willing to go through all those steps to enforce it with respect to the pardon power or any other power, Emoluments Clause, another great example, Declaration of a National Emergency, which arguably kind of outmaneuvered the appropriations power of Congress, all of these things then just sort of fade into the woodwork, and it's hard to bring them back when we don't like the president.
Well, that's why this book is so timely. And you got a great blurb from Jake Tapper from CNN, who said, "Not since the Nixon years have there been so many valid questions about the U.S. Constitution and its role in our lives. Whaley's book provides essential, compelling reading on this glorious document, a must-read for this era. The book is How to Read the Constitution and Why." And Kim Whaley is a professor of law, legal expert. You see her on CBS News. She's a contributor to The Bulwark. And I would highly recommend this for everybody wondering what is the status of constitutional law, the rule of law. This is, and this, even when you say it's an entry level book, it's very clear, but it's very, very substantive and it's very provocative. And I highly recommend it. Kim, thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, thank you, Charlie, for having me. It was great.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.